I was born 100,000 years ago, and there's nothing in this world I do not know.
This is Heritage Unbounded, a podcast series of the Cultural Heritage Management Graduate Program in the Krieger School of Arts and Sciences Advanced Academic Programs at Johns Hopkins University. Join us as we keep our finger on the pulse of heritage in our changing world. We will talk with leading heritage professionals in the field and discuss the biggest challenges and accomplishments of heritage today.
Fell in love with me, poor girl. We were married in Milwaukee secretly. Then I snuck around and shook her cause I went with General Hooker just to fight mosquitoes down in Tennessee.
Hello, my name is Sarah Chacon, and I am the Associate Director of the Cultural Heritage Management Graduate Program in the Krieger School of Arts and Sciences Advanced Academic Programs at Johns Hopkins University, and your host for Heritage Unbounded. Each month, we introduce you to a leading thinker in the heritage field and explore the latest issues in heritage here and abroad. Joining us today is Brian Michael Leone. Brian has 20 years of practical experience in historic preservation and cultural heritage management at the local, state, national, and international levels. He's a proven leader in collaborating with various communities of professional and avocational interest. Brian's primary work since 2009 has been in Iraq with the Iraqi Institute for the Conservation of Antiquities and Heritage. He currently fulfills this role by working as the Iraq Program Manager for the Smithsonian Institution's Museum Conservation Institute. Mr. Leone, through his firm, Leone Heritage Consulting, also works on complex historic preservation challenges as a consulting professional. In a volunteer capacity, Brian currently serves as a member of the Board of Trustees of the U.S. National Committee of the International Council on Monuments and Sites, or ICOMOS, and as the chair of that organization's International Exchange Program Committee. He's also a member of the ICOMOS Working Group on Iraq and Syria, and was recently appointed the U.S. National Focal Point for the ICOMOS Global Reconstruction Case Study Project. Brian served 8 years in Army Intelligence in active and reserve capacities and holds undergraduate and graduate degrees in historic preservation from Mary Washington College and Goucher College. I will also mention that we are lucky enough to have Brian teach for us in the Cultural Heritage Management Program in the Krieger School of Arts and Sciences Advanced Academic Programs here at Johns Hopkins University. So welcome, Brian. Thank you so much for joining. And given the interdisciplinary nature of the field, it's always so wonderful and interesting to learn how people end up in the heritage sector. So can you walk us through how you got started in the heritage field?
Sure, I'd happy to. I think that, as you mentioned, the interdisciplinary nature of it means that people come from a lot of different places. And that was certainly my experience. I don't want to go too far back, but when I was in the military, I served a lot in the Middle East and the Gulf, but it was after the first U.S. Gulf War and before the second one. So I was fortunate enough to be there during peacetime and spent a lot of time as a linguist working with foreign militaries. And once my job as a linguist was done, I was usually handed over to another protocol officer or someone else that I was working with, and they would always take me out into the desert or into their villages or into the towns to show me the cultural heritage that they were very proud of, be it an archaeological site, be it an ancient building. And it really struck me how close these individuals lived to their own history and how much of a sense of their history they had and how much of an understanding and just an innate appreciation for their history they had. So when I switched over from active duty military to reserve military, I went back to school and studied historic preservation. At the time, that seemed a thing that would kind of get me into the field as quick as possible, working on specifically historic buildings. That was my interest at the time. And so I went to school for 2 years and finished up some schooling that I'd started before I joined the Army, and got my degree in historic preservation, and then ended up working shortly after graduation as an intern with the U.S. ICOMOS International Exchange Program, which we can talk more about that later. But I got sent to Petra in Jordan, which is now a World Heritage Site, and worked for 3 months in Petra, documenting conditions of thousands of ancient Nabatean rock cut tombs. And I was absolutely hooked. It was amazing work, and I was very fortunate to have that opportunity. So from there, I kind of just moved forward and progressed from that internship. I ended up working for the military, but in a non-uniform or non-military capacity. Many people might not know that the U.S. military has cultural heritage professionals, primarily archaeologists, but historians and architectural historians and historic preservation professionals all across the United States. And in order to comply with their U.S. National Historic Preservation Act responsibilities, the military hires specialists to work on these military bases. And I ended up working at Fort Bragg in North Carolina for a little over a year and a half, again as an intern and working on their historic district. And they had a historic district that had been identified. It was probably 300 or 400 buildings, but it was not being managed. So there was a lot of management planning and policy that I learned about in school but hadn't had a chance to apply until then. So I was able to work there for a few years. Over time, I ended up continued work in the military in different capacities. So I worked on research and development grants, looking for archaeological sites from space way back in the late 90s and early 2000s. Before that was a big thing, as it is now. And I worked for consultants that had contracts with military bases. I worked on military bases. And so throughout the 2000s, I worked in various capacities. And by the middle of the 2000s, 2004, 2005, I found myself at the Pentagon and was running a cultural resources management program, a funding program that would annually give out money on a competitive basis. So it was kind of like a grant program. People would apply for military bases to work on heritage management and also natural heritage management challenges. And the office that I was working for would provide funding for those projects, with the idea that those grant projects would support and benefit all military management of natural and cultural resources. And I did that for a few years. And when I was in that office at the Pentagon, my overall supervisor at the time was getting the Pentagon more involved in the work of the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation, and specifically in the Pentagon's role in managing the policy and guidance of their cultural resources management program for the entire Department of Defense, so Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines. And she was given the role of federal preservation officer, which by the National Historic Preservation Act, every federal agency is meant to have one. And she named me her deputy. So I was the senior expert for cultural heritage management policy in support of the federal preservation officer. And I did that for a few years. And it was fascinating to see how the different federal agencies, and really even within an agency like defense, how the different military departments interpreted historic preservation mandates and cultural resources management obligations, and then implemented those on the ground. And worked there for a few years. And of course, in the middle of 2000s, this is when the United States had invaded Iraq in 2003, and as many are aware, there were several high-profile and very public issues of looting of the National Museum in Baghdad, heritage sites that were destroyed, and there was a real confusion over what defense's role, either actively or inactively, what the role was in kind of this destruction. The academic community was calling for blood, and the defense community was saying that it wasn't necessarily part of their mission to directly protect cultural heritage. And it was a difficult time. And I found that in working with colleagues in the State Department, both in Iraq at the embassy and in Washington, D.C., I got to know several of the primary people that were involved in protecting resources and trying to determine what could be done to either rebuild the capacity of Iraqis or specifically physically rebuild things like the Iraq National Museum. And in 2008, the State Department came up with the Iraq Cultural Heritage Project. They received some funding from the State Department in collaboration with the embassy in Baghdad. And that was a two-year project to rebuild both the capacity of Iraqi heritage professionals, but also do some physical rebuilding of some of the heritage institutions. And I was approached by colleagues that I had in the field that I'd been working with for a few years on these issues. And they said, well, look, you should apply for this job and come to Iraq and work on the project. I did apply. I actually applied for the director, the country director position of the Iraq Cultural Heritage Project, and went through a series of interviews and was turned down. I was told that I lacked certain museum experience that they wanted because the country director would be working in Baghdad, specifically on the National Museum, and that my museum background was not strong enough. But almost as a runner-up, as a consolation prize, I was offered the position of establishing a training institute in Erbil, which is in the north of Iraq. And that position was to be the deputy country director and to support the overall program, but also to run and manage this specific piece of this larger project. And I didn't know where Erbil was. I didn't know much about northern Iraq. And I did some research and accepted the position. So in the beginning of 2009, I left the Pentagon and took a position as the first director of the Iraqi Institute for the Conservation of Antiquities and Heritage, which at the time didn't have that title. It's something that's evolved over time. And so for 2 years, I worked with a great group of people, both domestically and in Iraq, to establish this institute. And the institute since then has been working to train specifically Iraqi heritage professionals in international standards for cultural heritage preservation and conservation. So the institute does everything from long-form training courses in artifact and object conservation to short-form courses teaching people how to conserve or stabilize or do preventive conservation on one specific object or one specific building material type. And so since 2009, that's been my primary work. I've worked there in a variety of different capacities. I've worked for different universities over the years. Much of the funding for the institute, for the operations of the institute anyway, and now the academic aspect of the institute has been from the U.S. government, either through the embassy or through the main State Department in Washington. And it's the institute has evolved over time. It's been managed fully by the Iraqis since early 2011. So after the first 2 years of the project, we transferred the management of the facility over to the Iraqis. And since then, myself and several other people, like a dozen or more people, are the primary points of contact in finding new opportunities for Iraqis to take courses, to learn more about their own heritage, and specifically to learn how to better manage their own heritage. So rather than leave the country for a week or 2 weeks, to go to a different country and see how other countries and other organizations manage their heritage, the Institute brings specialists from all over the world to Iraq and then works directly with Iraqis in Iraq. And we feel that approach is much more sustainable. There's something more deeper relationship that's established with the participants. We call them students, but with the Iraqi heritage professionals that come and participate in these classes. And so over the years, depending on funding sources and partners, both academic and private and non-governmental organizations, we've offered different courses at different times. Since the beginning of 2016, the Smithsonian Institution has been involved in delivering courses at the Institute. And throughout 2016, the Smithsonian delivered one of these long-form courses in Fundamentals of Heritage Conservation, which brought 18 Iraqi professionals from all over Iraq together to learn more about kind of the basics of heritage management and preventive conservation and assessment of heritage buildings, kind of a 101 class, if you will, that serves as a prerequisite then for advanced courses later on. Of course, with the advancement of ISIS, or they're called Daesh in Iraq, and the destruction of heritage, purposeful destruction of heritage in Iraq, the mission of the Iraqi Institute and the Smithsonian's focus as well has shifted. And so in the beginning of 2017, the Smithsonian started working under an agreement with the State Board of Antiquities and Heritage in Iraq, the National Iraqi Heritage Organization, to work with a team of individuals from Nineveh province. There's 18 provinces in Iraq. Nineveh province is where Mosul, city of Mosul, lies, and also where several very famous and very monumental sites, to include Nineveh, Hatra, and the site that we're working on, Nimrud, wherein they lie. So we work with now a team from Nineveh province, and we are specifically working to establish an action plan for this team to go to Nimrud which was liberated back in November of 2016, to go to Nimrud and systematically stabilize the site, do assessments of the site, and then begin to recover and salvage what they can from the site. 2015, the site was very famously detonated. Several barrel bombs were detonated, and many of the very famous carved reliefs and lamassu, which are giant winged bull, human-headed winged bulls that guarded the entrances to some of the palaces there, were detonated. And so it's a different focus for the Institute, since we're specifically working with one group of people on a specific task. But the idea where experts from all over the world, and Iraqi experts as well, come together to work with a group of people to improve their skills remains the same. So since that's what we've been doing since the beginning of the year. And I was brought on by the Smithsonian as an employee in the middle of June. So I'm very new to to working for the Smithsonian as an employee, but I've been working with them for the last several years. And my job now as the Iraq Program Manager for the Museum Conservation Institute at the Smithsonian is to help implement the specific Nimrud Rescue Project, which is what it's called, and also to identify opportunities, new sources of funding, new collaborations, to continue to bring people and organizations and expertise to Iraq and to the Iraqi Institute to benefit Iraqi heritage professionals. Nimrud is unfortunately not the only site that's been intensively damaged by ISIS. There are several other sites. And so the Nimrud Rescue Project is not only specifically training these individuals to work on Nimrud, but it's also working with them to develop a protocol, if you will, a path forward that can be utilized with modification elsewhere. So other sites, I mentioned Nineveh, the site of Nineveh, which is really inside of Mosul city limits. A similar type of stabilization and assessment and recovery will need to be done there. So we're hoping by working not only with this group specific for Nimrud, the site, but working with the provincial director of antiquities and their leadership and their management, that we can establish this protocol that they can then use on other sites with more of their staff. So that's where we are now. And it's been a very long trip from being a military linguist and interpreter in the deserts of the Gulf and in the middle of nowhere in the Emirates to working in Iraq as a preservation professional. But certainly my work seems to have come more or less full circle and working with people in the Middle East and now really focusing that work specifically on sites that people, just like the military personnel that I worked with back in the 90s, that they would show me sites that they were proud of and they felt were important. I'm now working with Iraqis who are working on sites that they're proud of and know that they're important. So that's kind of the very long arc of how I got into this and how far I've come and where I am now.
So see, it is interesting to learn how people end up in the heritage sector. And your experiences, Brian, they have taken you through many professional considerations of heritage, both here in the U.S. and abroad. And I'd have to agree with you, if Petra couldn't hook you, I don't think anything could.
I was very, very fortunate.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I see how it does come full circle. And so I wonder, with your work for the Iraqi Institute for the Conservation of Antiquities and Heritage and the work that you're doing now, how do sites get prioritized? So you're working with the folks from Nimrud, but as you mentioned, there are other sites as well that you're hoping the protocol gets set up for. How do those get prioritized? That prioritized by your group, the Iraqi government, or is it by need? How does that work?
In this case, it's something that the Iraqi Heritage Organization asked the Smithsonian to start work on Nimrud. So they were the ones that prioritized Nimrud over other sites. This is unique for us. We've not worked specifically on sites in the past. And one thing that the Iraqi Institute is very careful to differentiate ourselves from other, say, research centers. So, for example, there's the American Center of Oriental Research in Amman, Jordan, just next door. They welcome international researchers, particularly American researchers, to Amman and for people that are doing work throughout Jordan. And that is a resource for their researchers. There are several Jordanians involved in that operation, of course, and they are, of course, working on their own research and scholarship. But the primary focus is for American and international scholars to come and interface with Jordanians. There are similar organizations to that in Iraq, but the Iraqi Institute is not that. So we're very careful and very vocal to explain that we as the Iraqi Institute and the various organizations that are offering courses and training at the Institute, including the Smithsonian right now, that we are not there to do research and to come up with our own research designs and to tell the Iraqis what we want. We're there to provide the expertise and international standards and knowledge that the Iraqis need to better manage, prioritize, and work on their own heritage. And that's not an unsubtle difference. It's pretty different from what international research teams do. And therefore, it's always been confusing to a lot of people, particularly in the academic community, that are lacking an understanding or missing the piece where researchers are coming from foreign countries to do research on a certain site. So it's a long way of saying that the Smithsonian, in this case, and even the leadership of the Iraqi Institute, they're acting as a conduit for these skills and improving this facilities and giving training to Iraqis. But it's the Iraqi organization, specifically in this case, the Iraqi government, that's making this prioritization. Should they decide that they want to duplicate this process and take this protocol and work elsewhere, that we would ask them to tell us or to welcome other organizations to work the Iraqi Institute to teach people how to work on other sites. So I think it's very important that at the Institute, there's always been a priority of the Iraqi participants. Again, we call them students, but the Iraqi participants absolutely come first in all of this. So it's the Iraqis' needs. It can be challenging. When we first arrived in 2009, some of the Iraqis we worked with weren't really sure what their needs were because they really didn't have an understanding, they didn't have a recent understanding of what all of the issues might be. After a decade of war, sanctions before that, a decade of war before that with Iran, the heritage sector was just completely back on its heels, if not down on its knees, and a good 30 or 40 years out of date, as were many sectors in Iraq. And they've just been cut off from their international peers, unable to interact in international scholarship, and really were just behind the times based on the fact that they were cut off from the rest of the world. So the goal here is not just skills development in terms of teaching people how to work on a certain type of resource or certain material, but also the management aspect of this and how international heritage managers work in their countries with nonprofits, with government organizations, to set up national organizations or improve local offices to manage their own heritage. And so it's a little different than some organizations coming in and saying, well, we want to work only on this site and then seek permission, typically via permit, for example, from the Iraqi authorities. We're flipping this on its head, saying we're here to provide expertise and training, and you tell us where we can help you.
You've mentioned a lot of challenges. What do you see as the biggest hurdle for you guys to overcome with your work there?
I hate to be crass about it, but really funding is always the largest challenge. We are very, very fortunate, both with the Smithsonian and with other organizations that I've worked with over the years. The University of Delaware worked at the Institute for many years, and the University of Pennsylvania has worked there. There's been several foreign governments, to include the Italians and the Germans and the Poles, that have provided courses at the Institute. There's a welcoming atmosphere. The Iraqis have had just opened the doors, and anything is possible in Iraq. You just have to know the right person to ask. And that, I can't emphasize how amazing that is, that getting an Institute, it's a 10,000 square foot facility. We've got residential accommodations, we've got laboratories, and all of these things, getting this all set up in just a few years. And when it started out in the original Iraq Cultural Heritage Project, it was a few paragraphs that said that we would go set this institute up. All of that was possible because of the support that the program received from the Iraqi government, both the Kurdistan regional government, and that region is a subset, it's three provinces, a subset of the larger federal Iraq. It's where Erbil is located. Or the Iraqi Federal Heritage Authorities in Baghdad. Everyone's been extremely welcoming. And so anything is possible, like I say, it's just a matter of asking the right question of the right person and being welcome to figure that out. But the challenge is always funding. And in the earliest years, it was a challenge to find funding to continue programs. And again, since since this isn't a traditional research kind of approach, traditional and typical funders, nonprofits and government organizations outside of Iraq, we're not used to funding this type of work. There's a lot of places to get grants. I shouldn't say a lot. There are a few places to get grants to support specific research and site work or a specific project. But the idea of developing a large institute where the idea is capacity building and long-term sustainability and skills development, that's really difficult to raise money for. And organizations, private individuals, nonprofits, etc., that do grant work have a hard time understanding how continuing to support those types of efforts are worthwhile and beneficial in terms of how they give money. Of course, they understand that teaching is important, but it's difficult if they have a grant cycle that's going to provide a certain amount of money for 12 months. And at the end of 12 months, there needs to be a product typically. And if that were a specific archaeological investigation somewhere, that would be a report of the field season or any kind of output like that. Whereas when we train people, it's harder to quantify, and we can and we do go back and work with our alumni and find out where they are in the heritage organization and how the training has helped them. And we do a lot of listening sessions to find out what they need in terms of what the Iraqi heritage professionals need in terms of continuing education or new topics or new focuses, kind of like this changing the overall approach from a broader academic and training mission to a specific focus thing for Numerin. But none of that is possible without funding. And so that's the biggest challenge. And that was the earliest days into the middle reaches of the program. We're in 8.5 years now. And really since ISIS moved into Mosul, and then in the aftermath of that, the real challenge is advocating for funding for programs like this when there are so many other just basic human needs in terms of food, clothing, shelter, stabilizing the city of Mosul itself. And it's sometimes hard to ask and go and ask for funders for to support to continue these types of things. That said, it has been said many times that culture is a basic need, and supporting cultural heritage management and training cultural heritage managers is part of a reconstruction effort, and it's part of stabilizing communities. So it certainly maybe takes a backseat to the immediate needs of food, clothing, and shelter, but it's not too far behind in terms of what many, including us, feel the populace needs to support reconstruction efforts. So I hate to belabor the point, but it just always comes down to money. We have so many people that are interested in working on this, and organizationally, people want to come and help. Iraqis, of course, want to continue to send people from their heritage organizations to come, but all that takes money. And it's a lot less than people might expect, but it's still a funding need.
I would think that the work that you do there would impact the long-term sustainability of the heritage sector in the country. So it's very heartening to hear that it's been prioritized to such an extent on top of the humanitarian needs that they face, because these are very real and very immediate. Do you see any other similar efforts emerging in conflict zones in the Middle East, or is this really unique to the country of Iraq and sort of a result of some amazing synergies that you've been able to cultivate there?
Yeah, absolutely. Iraq is now and has been since 2003 a special case. I think that given the American involvement on the ground in Iraq, for better or for worse, that started a relationship between Iraq and the United States, both a fiscal relationship and a leadership and kind of developing and stabilizing the country. So I think it is unique as far as we've seen. Part of the process of setting this institute up is being able to work directly with the government and have them support the work that we do. And in other areas that are in conflict, Syria is right next door, of course, Afghanistan, then there's still conflict there. It's just not stable enough. And there are several efforts that have been working with Afghans, with Syrians, and with others, and then throughout Northern Africa, in countries that went through the Arab Spring and went through a period of unrest. And those efforts are more individualized. They tend to be more project-based. The Smithsonian, in fact, different part of the Smithsonian works on a project where they're working with Syrian heritage professionals, but they are outside the country because it's too dangerous for them to travel back and forth. They are working to improve conditions wherever they can in Syria, but it's difficult, of course, when there isn't a formal government that our government, the United States government, recognizes to work with. Afghanistan is a similar situation where it's just difficult to get people on the ground and set things up. But that said, the University of Chicago has been working on a project with the National Museum in Kabul for a few years now and working to improve their skills. So similar projects exist. We like to think that we are a model for other projects in some way, or at least the idea that these types of collaborations are possible and that kind of a long-term presence is also possible. But there's so much work, so much more work that's needed throughout the region. As places stabilized and hopefully as places become more safe, that this will be possible for heritage managers to get back to work.
Well, I'm sure you've heard this before, but you guys are doing some really good work there in Iraq. And it's very heartening to hear the kinds of efforts and the kinds of support that you're receiving. So I know it's challenging. Funding is a significant challenge. And I hope it doesn't hamstring you in the future. I also want to talk to you a little bit about the International Exchange Program Committee, because you're also the chair for the International Exchange Program Committee for the International Council on Monuments and Sites. And you talked a little bit about that in your intro when you talked about your work in Petra. Can you tell us a little bit about the history of the program and what that is?
Sure. So as you mentioned, the International Council on Monuments and Sites, some people say ICOMOS, some people say ICOMOS, has several national committees. It itself is an international organization. It's an international non-governmental organization that has a statutory role to support UNESCO in implementation of the World Heritage Convention. That's kind of its bread and butter at the international level. However, national committees that make up ICOMOS have different missions and different capacities as well. So ICOMOS was founded in 1965. The U.S. National Committee, or U.S. ICOMOS, was also founded in 1965, shortly thereafter. And so it's been about 50 years or so, that ICOMOS and U.S. ICOMOS have been working on international cultural heritage issues. And as the name suggests, monuments and sites, it's more of a built environment organization, contrasting, say, heritage management of, say, museums or archaeological sites. That said, as the heritage management field has changed over the years, so has the organization. And again, different national committees have different focuses and different ways of connecting, say, members of a national committee to international heritage practice. The Venice Charter, for example, in 1964, is kind of one of the touchstones of the international heritage management policy community. And that was written during an ICOMOS conference, one of their first. In fact, the one that went on to form ICOMOS. So before they were even ICOMOS, they came up with the Venice Charter. And then several organizations, or several documents and policies since. U.S. ICOMOS has, since 1984, been running the International Exchange Program. And it's been referred to as the Summer Intern Program, as the Intern Program, as the International Exchange Program. But since 1984, the organization has exchanged over 700 people worldwide, and it aims to take people that are either in graduate school or young professionals, people that are within 3 years of graduation, from a heritage topic. Predominantly, it is a historic preservation, cultural heritage management program, but we do occasionally have some archaeologists, some museum professionals, some people that work in cultural landscapes, etc., work or apply to the program. And so it is exactly what it sounds like. We send people abroad and we bring people from overseas to the United States. And depending on a given year, the program in the last couple of years averages between 10 and 15 participants. And it's bilateral. So we send U.S. people overseas and we bring people from many different countries back to the U.S. But it's not a program that would take someone, say, from France and send them to Morocco and then send a Moroccan to Iraq or anything like that. It is kind of a two-way street. But that program provides real-world field experience for 3 months during the summer to young professionals or people that are young to the profession. And what we see in the last couple of years especially is that people are going back to school either to change careers or to change their specialization in the field. And so that's why we are very clear to say that if someone's graduated from a higher level academic program in the last 3 years, they're eligible to apply. So it's not just people that are in their second year of grad school or just graduating from grad school the first time, but we have mid-career and late-career professionals that have applied to the program as well. And it's kind of a bespoke program. We build it every year by hand. So we have an application process for hosts, and an intern host has to have an established project that the intern can work on. That project has to be something that has real-world application. It can't be just scut work and have someone come over and organize files in an office for a summer. And so, for example, when I worked in Petra back in 1999, under this same program, I was walking every day with another heritage professional. He's a photographer, actually, and he and I were traveling from rock-cut tomb facade to rock-cut tomb facade. I would do the condition assessments, and he would do the existing conditions photography. And then at night, we would sit down and work on reports. And that report, we worked on, 250 or 300 of them throughout the summer, was provided to a university in Jordan that was working on a larger management plan with Jordanian and other organizations internationally. So it was work that I was doing that was kind of tedious, kind of tiresome, but necessary, good grad school kind of level work. And that work, I've bumped into the professor that I worked with all those years ago. I've bumped into him at conferences over the years, and he's always been sure to tell me that, thank me for the work that I did and to let me know that it's still work that is used today. So it has to be a real world experience. So getting a host to agree to not only host someone for a project, they also are obligated to assist with finding housing, and then really to try to make this a cultural experience. This isn't just about work. This is about learning more about other cultures. And that is something that in the last several years, and especially, has become more and more important, where the heritage management piece of this is, of course, quite important, but just as important is making sure that we build bridges between U.S. heritage professionals and the international heritage community, and that in a time when the U.S. is increasingly losing its footing in international heritage conservation, and making sure that the international community is aware of people at all levels. So there are the higher level folks, of course, that work internationally, both in US ECOMOS and national committees of other international organizations, but that the international community sees that there are young people and people young to the field that are interested in working abroad and interested hosts in the US, interested in bringing people over to the States to work on projects. So it being a volunteer position for me, and being a volunteer board position and a nonprofit organization that relies on membership, the program every year kind of depends on, again, how much funding we have to support how many participants. So this year we have 13, in fact, 7 from the US that are overseas, and 6 from, Lithuania, India, Ethiopia, Pakistan. In any case, they're all in the States this summer and working in different places. And then we've got people in India and Lithuania and France and Jordan and a few other places that are doing work. So it changes year to year. We have a few organizations that host people every year. The Preservation Institute in Nantucket, which is managed by the University of Florida, long, long-standing field school, great preservation field school, has been great about taking at least one, if not two. This year they took two interns. And as part of that agreement, then someone from the University of Florida program applies, and if they pass all the, get through all the wickets and meet the standards, they go abroad themselves. So there's a woman that graduated from the Florida program who's in India this summer, and at the same time there's a woman from Ethiopia and a woman from India that are in Nantucket working this summer. So we're not only building these bridges, we're starting people out early in terms of building a network of professionals and trying to make sure that that they keep these connections and communications up. I still know people and work with people that I met 15, 20 years ago, well, 15 years ago, working on this project. And it's been a great thing for me to see the work that I do, along with the rest of the International Exchange Program Committee, continue the same opportunities, provide the same opportunities to people that I was provided with way back in 1999. And I know I would not be doing the work I do in Iraq today had I not had the opportunity to go to Jordan with US ECOMOS as a summer intern in 1999. It's just, I don't see how those connections would have been made otherwise. So I can draw a straight line between the work that I do right now and that chance that I had back in the late 90s to travel abroad. So I think the program's great. If anything, it's too successful. We get hundreds of applications every year, and I'm the chair of a 5-member committee, and we spend a lot of hours sorting through applications and trying to match them to hosts. That same process can also be a challenge because we always have more qualified people than we do positions. We make sure to keep in touch with folks and ask them to reapply each year if they can. If they've missed out the first year, hopefully in the second or third year, they can reapply and find a position that works for them.
It sounds like a really wonderful opportunity for emerging heritage professionals to get some on-the-ground experience while, as you suggest, building bridges with the international heritage community. And I think that's such a great aspect of that program, creating those not just national networks, but international networks with heritage professionals around the world. And it sounds like you have a pretty diverse group of folks this summer for that program. I've been watching the updates on Facebook and on your website for the students that have been taking part this summer. And it looks like a great group of people and like they're really enjoying themselves. So what a wonderful program. And we hope to see it continue. Now, I'd like to take a quick minute, Brian, and draw our scope out a little bit and sort of looking at heritage very broadly. And if we do that, based on your professional and personal experiences, which you've had quite a few in both a national and international context, what do you see as the biggest challenge facing the heritage field or the heritage sector today?
I see that the field has, in many ways, has splintered into several different cottage industries that implement key pieces of legislation or programs. So, for example, there's an entire industry, again, use the same word, but industry that works around the implementation of Section 106 of the National Historic Preservation Act here in the U.S. And that act, that section of the act, for the listeners that don't know, it basically obligates federal agencies to consider the effects of their actions, their undertakings, on historic properties, and that includes archaeology and Native American resources and heritage buildings, and it's a whole big list of things. And there's a role in that consultative process to involve the public, and it's a pretty special piece of legislation. And the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation is a small federal agency that was set up at the same time that the Act was passed in 1966 to oversee implementation of this section and other pieces of the Act. And I don't think that the framers of that piece of legislation ever expected there to be dozens, if not hundreds, of cultural resources management firms that specialize just in doing survey work and identifying every bridge and culvert and flagpole and fence in the world that might be a historic property, that might be impacted by an undertaking with federal money. And so I think that sometimes we miss the forest for the trees. And I think that that's also the case in World Heritage. I think that the idea behind preparing World Heritage nominations has gotten very specialized and very niche. And again, people are missing the idea of the importance of World Heritage because it is something that can be highly politicized, part of how the World Heritage Committee works and votes on properties. But even to get to the point where things are being looked at, say for a tentative list or a nation's tentative list of World Heritage listings, or to get things put on the World Heritage List, there are experts that provide consultative services in the tens, hundreds, millions of dollars range. It's amazing how expensive it can be to put together a really well-crafted defense of something that should be inscribed on the World Heritage List and to prove that outstanding universal value. And again, I don't think that the World Heritage Convention really had that in mind when it came up with this idea of listing things of outstanding universal value around the world. So I think that's the biggest challenge. I think that we're all spending too much time in our own little stovepipes. I don't want to call them little. I don't want to belittle this because I also think that this is all important work. And I don't want to advocate that any of this goes away. But I think that there needs to be more interdisciplinary collaboration. I think that there needs to be more democratization of this work, that it can't just be the specialists of the world that are doing this work in a vacuum. I helped out a local college here in northeastern Pennsylvania with a historic bridge that they had on their property that the state organization, the state Department of Transportation, was looking to replace. And they were pulled into this review and comment process, really without any understanding of what the process was. And they asked me to help them kind of demystify this. I think that that's a problem when you have a program like one that's based on the Historic Preservation Act or one that's based on the World Heritage Convention, where it's meant to involve the general public. It's meant to support and be for the benefit of the general public. However, it really excludes the general public in the process itself, even though there are specific carve-outs in these things that say, oh, you have to talk to the public, you have to involve the public. But it's shrouded in this mystery, and without practitioners that are specialized in certain jargon and certain processes, it's difficult to really participate and to have one's voice heard. And that's changed over time. I know that several federal agencies in this country, UNESCO and then other international organizations, other nations, have tried to do a lot to diversify what is cultural heritage. Definition has broadened. The types of disciplines that work in cultural heritage management and historic preservation have broadened. And so it's all a matter of time as we take time to expand this. But in doing that, we're still not really taking a close look at these cottage industries that have sprung up. And I think we're missing out on an opportunity to really get everybody to the table to talk about heritage, why heritage is important, because the process of getting them to the table is so opaque, really. So I think that's the greatest challenge. I think that we're endangering ourselves in terms of a field, a professional field, by successively, we're trying to pull people in, we're trying to pull more diverse communities in and get more voices to the table. But by doing so, we're making that process even more complicated and difficult to get anybody to the table. So it's kind of this weird kind of push-pull. And that, I think, is the greatest challenge to what we do as kind of cultural heritage managers in general.
What do you see as the best thing happening in the field of heritage right now?
What I see happening is that there are more people interested in heritage, and young people, people that are new to the field. For better or for worse, there seems to be a lot of focus, if you will, or at least attention around heritage and conflict and heritage in times of disaster. And that's bringing people to a field that they may not realize is much broader and deeper than simply, oh, this place is important, this ancient heritage site is important. So I think that that's kind of conversely and kind of perversely kind of good, that while bad guys, terrorists are committing wanton acts of destruction against heritage and destroying not only the physical remnants of a people, but just chipping away at the soul of a people, that's awful. But if anything good is coming out of that, I think it's really raising awareness for the heritage management field in general and bringing more people to the table that are interested in it. And when people, especially young people, or again, people that are young to the field, get to the point where they realize, oh, wow, ISIS blew up a place in Iraq, or ISIS is targeting places in Syria, that's terrible. I want to learn more about this. They get drawn into this world and realize that there's so many other things that they could be interested in doing. And so we find that we're bringing people in from different backgrounds, and you're getting art historians, you're getting curators, and you're getting museums people and archaeologists and buildings people that are all kind of rallying around this single point and saying that destruction of heritage, any type of heritage, anybody's heritage, is awful. And there's no call for it. It's just something that cannot happen, should not happen. And by having new people come to the field, hopefully will not continue to happen. So that to me is a silver lining in all this. Kind of out of destruction and chaos is this hope of having more people involved and getting different voices, as I mentioned earlier, that are involved. Because they see terrible things happening, and they want to make a difference. And they didn't realize previously that they had some sort of stake in all this, that they had some sort of standing. What they can do locally to manage heritage is just as important as people that are working internationally to protect and preserve heritage. And I think that to me is the biggest bright spot right now, is that you see people really evaluating and reevaluating what's important to them. And I hope that that means that they're then taking a look at the community around them, be it a small town or be it a big city, but starting to understand that there are ways to quantify and qualify the values that they place on their own heritage, kind of help describe that, and then to manage that in a structure and a system. And some of the structures and systems don't work and need to be revised or thrown away entirely. And I think as part of that process, we'll get new structures and systems that will hopefully continue to change and evolve. So that's the bright spot. I think that the people that are coming in new and fresh are really helping to revitalize this idea of cultural heritage and managing cultural heritage and becoming tomorrow's leaders, which is wonderful.
Well, it's always great to end with the silver lining. So thank you, Brian. Thank you for joining us for our inaugural episode of Heritage Unbounded. It's been a pleasure to hear about your work and its challenges and rewards, which are many. And I think we are all hopeful about what's being done here in the US and abroad in the heritage sector. And thank you to heritage professionals like yourself. We have those silver linings. So thank you, Brian, and thank you all for listening.
Spread the word and invite your friends, and join us again next time for another episode of Heritage Unbounded, brought to you by the Cultural Heritage Management Graduate Program in the Krieger School of Arts and Sciences Advanced Academic Programs at Johns Hopkins University. Podcast music features Born 100,000 Years Ago by Cisco Houston from the album The Folkways Years, 1944 to 1961, provided courtesy of Smithsonian Folkways Recordings, copyright 1994 and used by permission.
And I help bring him young and vent Limburger cheese. Well, I sail out on the bay with Methuselah one day, and I saved his flowing whiskers from the breeze.